A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
27. That's the average age this hits. Hannah's mid-20s flight to her parents was almost exactly on schedule, statistically speaking.
And the weirdest part is, she'd loved it before. Airport, passport control, terrible food, the whole thing. Then one flight, out of nowhere, terror.
Hannah sent us this one. She says Daniel's done plenty of aviation episodes because he's a fan, and she is too, in theory. But somewhere in her mid-20s, she developed a fear of flying she never had before. She grew up loving every part of it, even the bad meals in the movies. She's always had a fear of heights, but she used to enjoy pushing herself through scary things, climbing, ropes courses, those giant swing rides. Then one flight to visit her parents in the States, and she was terrified for the first time. Since then, flying has been a recurring source of anxiety, especially takeoff and landing. It's gotten better, and she says learning what the strange airplane noises actually are has helped enormously. When she flies with Daniel and he explains that a sound is normal, what the engines are doing, what's part of landing, it makes a huge difference. So she's asking four things. Why would someone develop a fear of flying as an adult when they previously loved it? How common is that, and what actually causes it? Is it really about heights? Lack of control, turbulence, the feeling that flying is somehow unnatural, or some combination, and what are the most effective ways to get over it, or at least get to the point where a long flight feels normal again instead of hours spent managing anxiety?
The first thing to say is that her experience is so common it has a name among practitioners: sudden onset aerophobia. And the second thing is that it's usually not sudden at all.
Walk me through that.
The pilot and therapist who founded the SOAR program, Tom Bunn, has been treating this since the early 80s. He says the story he hears again and again is exactly what Hannah described. I used to fly fine. I don't know what happened. It doesn't make sense. And his answer is that in most cases, it wasn't a bad flight. It was non-flying trauma that caught up with them. An accumulation of small experiences involving not being in control, which crosses a threshold somewhere in the late 20s.
So the plane is just where the bill comes due.
That's the clinical picture. His average age of onset is 27. Cleveland Clinic puts the peak window at 17 to 34, which they note is full of life transitions. Graduation, marriage, having a child, moving countries. Hannah was flying to visit her parents, but she'd recently gone through major life changes. The literature says as life gets fuller and more meaningful, people become more aware of what they have to lose. A formerly neutral activity becomes, in one practitioner's phrasing, an activity in which a person cheats death, one flight at a time.
That's grim.
It is, but it also explains why it felt different from her fear of heights. Cleveland Clinic is blunt about this. Most people with aerophobia aren't actually afraid of the plane crashing. They're afraid of the overwhelming anxiety that comes with being on the plane. Bunn puts it even more directly. We call it fear of flying, but in most cases, it's fear of having a panic attack on the plane.
And a plane is the one place you can't step outside and get air.
You can't escape to somewhere else. That's why it often presents as claustrophobia, even when the person isn't claustrophobic anywhere else. Jonathan Bricker at the University of Washington warns about misdiagnosis. A patient whose real diagnosis is panic disorder with agoraphobia isn't necessarily afraid to fly. They're afraid of having a panic attack on the plane. The plane is just the place where you have the panic attack.
That matches what Hannah said about the swings and the ropes courses. She used to enjoy fear when she'd chosen it and could stop it.
Right. The control is the variable, not the height. She could get off the swing, she could come down from the ropes course. You can't get off the plane at 35,000 feet. The fear of loss of internal control, panicking, losing control of yourself, not being able to escape, is distinct from fear of loss of external control, something happening to the plane. And they respond differently to treatment.
So, how common is this trajectory? Loving it, and then losing it?
That's the part where the numbers get messy. Prevalence estimates for fear of flying range from 2.5% to 40%, depending on whether you're counting clinically significant phobia or self-identified fear. A 2026 qualitative study put clinically significant aviophobia at 3 to 5% of the population. Cleveland Clinic says about 25 million adults in the U.S. The APA says as many as 40% of people say they fear flying, though a lower percentage fits formal diagnostic criteria.
That's a wide band.
And there's no clean epidemiological answer for the specific question of how many people developed it in adulthood after enjoying flying before. The term sudden onset aerophobia is largely a practitioner coinage. Thrillist did a piece on it in 2024 and stated plainly there isn't a lot of research around it as a distinct phenomenon. The closest evidence is indirect. Bunn's average onset age of 27, Cleveland Clinic's 17 to 34 window, and the qualitative finding that onset is usually multifactorial rather than a single traumatic event.
So Hannah's experience is textbook, but the textbook hasn't been written yet.
That's fair. And here's the part that contradicts most people's intuition. Cleveland Clinic says it's very rare for aerophobia to stem from a traumatic experience on a flight. Very rare. Most people assume a bad flight must be the trigger. The evidence says the bad flight is usually incidental.
What about the cluster of aviation incidents last year? The Reagan National Collision, the Toronto crash, the Air India one. That has to be doing something to the baseline.
It is, and the numbers are stark. After those incidents, a Harris poll of just over 2,000 adults found two-thirds reported heightened nerves about flying, and one in four described themselves as far more fearful. The APA ran a feature on this in September, and there's a documented amplifier beyond the incidents themselves. Bunn points out that the way we get news has changed. When there's an aviation story and you click on it, you're going to get more aviation stories. The algorithm feeds the fear.
So even though flying keeps getting safer, the anxiety environment keeps getting worse.
And there's a physical piece too. Severe clear air turbulence is up 55% since the 70s, and that's tied directly to rising flight anxiety. A 2024 study of business travelers found fear of flying scores correlated with stress and trauma symptoms at a coefficient of 0.46 and with burnout at 0.3. It's not just the plane, it's what you're carrying onto the plane.
Let me push on the heights question because Hannah specifically asked about it. She has a fear of heights. She's saying the flying fear felt different. Is that diagnostically meaningful?
It is. The sources consistently point to control, panic, and claustrophobia as the primary drivers, not heights. Acrophobia is listed as a co-occurring amplifier, not the main event. A clinical psychologist named John Hart put it well. I don't think humans evolved to fly around at 40,000 feet in tubes of steel. The unnatural feeling is real and near universal, even among non-phobic flyers. But the phobic response is usually about something else layered on top.
The tube of steel is also a tube you can't leave.
And a tube where other people can see you if you panic. Hart says some people fear the potential terror of the crash-related process itself rather than fear of dying, and some fear appearing anxious in front of others. The social dimension is underrated. You're trapped with strangers, and you're supposed to act normal while your body is telling you you're in danger.
That's the part nobody says out loud. The performance of calm.
Stephanie Cherostal at Weill Cornell describes a category she calls endurers. People who are equally afraid but white-knuckle their way through with medications, alcohol, or prayer. They look fine to the person in the next seat, but they're managing for hours.
Which brings us to what actually works. Hannah said learning the noises helped enormously. Is that a real thing or just her experience?
It's real and it's underrated. The psychoeducation angle is backed by the literature. Understanding what sounds mean, quantifying turbulence, hearing pilots say that's normal, these are documented anxiety reducers. The Smithsonian ran a piece where Captain John Cox's 14,000 hours of flight time decoded every ding, buzz, and whir. His line was that airplanes talk to you, all you have to do is listen. It's like listening to your car.
That's a good frame. Your car makes noises, and you don't panic because you know what they are.
One sufferer in the Thrillist piece, a software engineer, said he started to quantify turbulence as a value instead of an emotional response. That reframe alone was huge for him. He described the fear as being the salt in the salt shaker. He didn't want to be the salt in the salt shaker.
I understand that image completely.
So Daniel explaining the noises during takeoff and landing is doing real clinical work. The engine spooling up, the landing gear retracting, the flaps extending, the thump when the gear doors close, the change in engine pitch at cruise. Each of those has a name and a reason.
Let's do a few. Since Hannah specifically said that helps, what are the noises people hear on takeoff?
The first thing is the engine spooling up as the pilots advance the throttles. That high-pitched whine is the fan blades and compressors spinning faster, pulling in huge amounts of air. Then there's a thump or a series of thumps. That's the landing gear retracting into the wheel wells and the doors closing behind it. You'll also hear the flaps and slats retracting as the plane accelerates and cleans itself up, which changes the airflow noise. And there's often a brief reduction in engine noise shortly after takeoff, which is the pilots reducing from takeoff thrust to climb thrust. That can feel like the engines are failing. They're not. It's a standard noise abatement procedure.
The noise abatement part is important. People hear the engines pull back and think something's wrong.
It's the opposite of wrong. It's a planned reduction because the plane doesn't need full takeoff thrust anymore. On landing, you hear the flaps and slats extending again, which creates a lot of drag and changes the pitch of the airflow. You hear the landing gear extending, which is a mechanical whir followed by a thunk as it locks into place. And then there's the spoilers deploying after touchdown, that roaring sound as the panels on top of the wing pop up to kill lift and put the weight on the wheels.
And the ding after takeoff?
That's usually the flight attendants being signaled that it's safe to get up. The dings during the flight are often the cabin crew calling each other. They have a code. One ding might mean a passenger pressed the call button. Two dings might mean the crew is communicating something routine. The point is, none of these are the plane telling you it's about to fail.
So the knowledge work is real. But what about the formal treatments? What does the evidence say actually works?
Exposure therapy plus cognitive behavioral therapy is the gold standard. A study out of Emory found roughly 3/4 of patients completed their first post-treatment graduation flight, and nearly that many were still flying a year later. A 2015 study of a one-day CBT plus virtual reality program with 145 subjects found large effect sizes across the board.
Virtual reality. Is that the magic bullet or not?
This is contested. Early studies suggested VR beat imaginal exposure. But a 2025 head-to-head randomized controlled trial found VR wasn't superior to plain two-dimensional video exposure, with gains maintained at 24 months. Bunn is openly critical of VR. He says the studies haven't sufficiently compared before and after outcomes. So the honest answer is, VR works, but it's not obviously better than watching videos of flights.
That's a useful thing to know. You don't need expensive equipment. You can watch takeoff and landing videos on your phone.
And the counterintuitive core technique from the clinical literature is that the more you struggle against flying anxiety, the more anxious you become. Hart says the goal is to develop a willingness to experience the anxiety rather than trying to get rid of it. Not only is it okay to be anxious, but you're learning to tolerate your anxiety, and you're actually making progress when you're anxious.
That's a hard sell to someone in the middle of a panic attack at 30,000 feet.
It is, but it's the mechanism. The anxiety isn't the enemy. The avoidance is the enemy. Every time you avoid flying, you teach your brain that flying was dangerous, and you escaped. The treatment is to fly anyway and let the anxiety come and go without fighting it.
What about medication? Hannah didn't ask about it directly, but it's the obvious next question.
Clinicians are pretty consistent. Alcohol and as-needed benzodiazepines interfere with the ability to manage anxiety more consciously. Cleveland Clinic says medication isn't very effective for long-term management. The crutch prevents the learning that you can cope. If you take a pill every time you fly, your brain never gets the evidence that you can survive the anxiety without it.
So the crutch is also the thing that keeps you on the crutch.
And there's a shame dimension. Bricker says aviophobia isn't valued the same as other disorders, so it creates a lot of shame. People don't realize there are effective options. They think they're just bad at flying.
Let me go back to something. Hannah said it's gotten much better over the years. Is that typical?
It is, especially with continued exposure. Bricker stresses maintaining exposure and increasing flight length. A short graduation flight is a major mastery experience, a huge confidence builder. The people who get better are the ones who keep flying. The people who stay stuck are the ones who avoid.
And the people who get better often describe a shift that isn't about the plane at all. There was a woman in one of the pieces who said once she really surrendered to life in general, it became easier. There's very little we really can control.
Lynn Capsulors, 61. That's the through line. The fear of flying is usually a fear of something else wearing a plane costume.
So let me try to answer Hannah's four questions directly. 1. Why would someone develop this as an adult? Because the fear was never about the plane. It was about control, and control became more precious as life got fuller. 2. How common is it? Common enough that the average onset age is 27, and the clinical window runs from 17 to 34. 3. Is it really about heights? Usually not. It's about control, panic, claustrophobia, and the feeling of being trapped. Heights can amplify it, but it's not the core. 4. What works? Exposure plus cognitive behavioral therapy, psychoeducation about the noises and procedures, and the counterintuitive work of tolerating anxiety instead of fighting it.
And one more thing on the psychoeducation front. There are pilot-led services where you can actually call a pilot and ask questions before your flight. Dial A Pilot is one. The idea is that a human being who's done this thousands of times tells you what's normal. It's the Daniel effect, formalized.
The Daniel effect. He's going to love that.
He is. And it's real. The Thrillist writer who covered this said learning what happened, learning the protocols, and really hearing from pilots who say, oh yeah, that's not a big deal, this is what it is, was life-changing for her.
There's something almost absurd about the fact that the fix is information. You're sitting in a metal tube at 35,000 feet, and the thing that calms you down is someone saying the thump was the landing gear door.
But information is control. It's the closest thing to control you can have when you voluntarily hand a control to two people you've never met.
And that's the deal with flying. You hand over control completely. You can't pull over. You can't get out. You can't even see what's happening up front.
Unless you listen. The plane is telling you what it's doing the whole time.
Let me ask you something. You're the one who reads the papers. Is there anything in the literature about why some people get better and some people don't?
The predictors are pretty consistent. The people who get better are the ones who keep exposing themselves, who learn the facts, who have a support system, and who don't use avoidance or substances as their primary strategy. The people who stay stuck are the ones who fly as little as possible and medicate heavily when they do. The medication prevents the learning. The avoidance prevents the exposure. It's a loop.
And the people who get better don't necessarily become fearless. They become tolerant.
That's the goal. Not zero anxiety. Manageable anxiety. The willingness to feel it and fly anyway. Hart's line about making progress when you're anxious is the whole thing. The anxiety is the treatment.
That's almost a koan.
It's the hardest part to accept. Nobody wants to hear that the way out is through.
What about the turbulence piece? She mentioned it as a possible cause. The research said clear air turbulence is up 55%. That's a real physical change, not just perception.
And it's worth being precise about what that means. Severe clear air turbulence is up 55% since the 1970s. That's the kind that happens without visual warning, no clouds, no storm. It's tied to climate change and changes in the jet stream. But severe turbulence is still rare. The plane is designed to handle far more than it ever encounters in normal operations. The limit is structural, not comfort.
So the plane is fine. The passengers are just uncomfortable.
And the discomfort is real. Turbulence is unpleasant. But the reframe that worked for the salt shaker guy was quantifying it. Light, moderate, severe. Most turbulence passengers experience is light to moderate. Severe is rare and the plane is built for it.
I keep thinking about the phrase from the research. An activity in which a person cheats death, one flight at a time. That's how the anxious brain frames it. But the actual risk is vanishingly small.
The actual risk is so small that the drive to the airport is statistically more dangerous. But statistics don't touch the fear. The fear isn't about probability, it's about control and escape.
And the fear of the fear. The panic about the panic.
That's the loop. The fear of having a panic attack on the plane is often worse than the fear of the plane itself. Because you can't leave, you can't step outside, you can't call someone, you're trapped with your own nervous system.
So the treatment is to make peace with your nervous system.
And to give it better information. The noises, the procedures, the physics. Your nervous system is making predictions based on bad data.
I want to circle back to something Hannah said. She used to enjoy pushing herself to do things that scared her. Climbing, ropes courses, swing rides. That's interesting because it suggests she's not someone who avoids fear. She seeks it out in controlled doses.
And that's exactly the profile of someone who responds well to exposure therapy. She already knows how to do the thing. She just needs to apply it to a context where the exit is less obvious.
The swing ride has a queue and a harness and an operator. The plane has a seatbelt and a safety card.
But the plane is actually safer than the swing ride. By orders of magnitude, the difference is the duration and the lack of an obvious exit.
So the work is to convince the part of her brain that handles fear that the plane is just a very long swing ride with better safety statistics.
To let the fear come without fighting it. That's the part that feels wrong. The instinct is to push the fear down, to distract, to medicate. The evidence says the opposite. Let it come. Watch it. Describe it. It peaks, and then it falls.
Ah, like a wave.
A wave you can ride instead of fight.
I wonder how much of this applies to other fears. The mechanism, not the content.
It applies to almost all of them. The fear of the fear is the engine. The content is almost incidental.
Anna's question about whether it's heights or control or turbulence or unnaturalness. The answer is yes.
It's all of them, but the weight is on control and the fear of panic. Heights and turbulence are amplifiers. The unnaturalness is real but universal. The core is being trapped with your own nervous system in a place you can't leave.
The fix is information plus exposure plus tolerance.
Plus time. She said it's gotten much better over the years. That's the exposure doing its work. Every flight she takes is a data point for her brain that she can survive it.
The brain is a slow learner when it comes to fear.
It's a fast learner and a slow forgetter. That's why consistency matters. The people who get better are the ones who keep flying.
Let me ask you one more thing. The research mentioned that 2/3 of people who fear flying will meet criteria for another anxiety disorder in their lifetime. What does that mean for someone like Hannah?
It means the fear of flying is often a symptom of a broader anxiety profile, not a standalone phobia. That's not a reason to worry. It's a reason to look at the whole picture. If you treat the flying fear in isolation, you might miss the underlying pattern.
But the flying fear is also the most treatable version, because you can practice it.
You can't practice being afraid of heights every day. You can book a flight.
The flight has a beginning, middle, and end. It's a contained exposure.
With a built-in reward. You end up somewhere new.
Or somewhere with your parents.
Which is where this started for her. A flight to visit her parents.
That's the thing about the onset. It wasn't a flight to a war zone. It was a flight to see her family. The most routine flight imaginable.
Which is more evidence that the flight wasn't the trigger. The life context was the trigger. The flight was just where the anxiety surfaced.
What would you tell her if she asked you directly what to do?
Keep doing what she's doing. Fly with Daniel. Ask him to narrate the noises. Learn the procedures. Quantify the turbulence. And when the anxiety comes, don't fight it. Let it peak and fall. Every flight is a treatment session.
Book the flights. Don't avoid.
Book the flights. The avoidance is the only thing that makes it worse.
I think there's something almost hopeful in this. The thing she's already doing, the Daniel narration, is clinically validated. She found the treatment before she knew it was a treatment.
She did. And the fact that it's gotten better means the treatment is working. She's not stuck. She's in the middle of the recovery curve.
The recovery curve. That's a good way to put it.
It's not linear. Some flights will be worse than others. But the trend is the thing.
The trend is toward normal. A long flight feeling normal again instead of hours spent managing anxiety.
That's the goal she named. And it's achievable. The evidence says so.
I keep thinking about the phrase from the research. You're actually making progress when you're anxious.
That's the one. That's the whole episode in one line.
It's counterintuitive enough to be annoying.
True enough to be useful.
The answer to Hannah's question is that she's not broken and she's not alone. She's a textbook case with a good prognosis.
She's already doing the right thing. The narration, the repetition, the willingness to keep flying.
The only thing left is to let the anxiety be there without treating it as a failure.
The anxiety is the treatment.
I think that's the line we end on.
It's a good one.
You keep saying the landing gear makes a thump.
We do.
It's not a thump. It's a clunk. A thump is what the nose gear makes when it touches down. The retraction is a clunk, then a whir, then a clunk when the doors close. I worked ramp at Bradley for 2 summers in the late 2000s. You hear it from the tarmac, and it's a clunk. The thump is the touchdown.
That's a fair correction. The sequence is clunk, whir, clunk.
The ding after takeoff isn't always the flight attendants. On some aircraft, it's the landing gear being fully up and locked. The crew gets a light and a chime. Depends on the type.
The ding is the plane saying the gear is stowed.
On some types, yes. On others, it's the cabin crew signal. The point is, you can't tell from the passenger cabin which one it is, and it doesn't matter. The ding is never the plane telling you something's wrong. Wrong is a different sound.
What does wrong sound like?
You'd know. It's not a ding.
That's unsettlingly vague.
It's not vague. Wrong is loud, and it doesn't sound like anything you've heard before. The dings and the clunks and the whirs are all normal. They're the plane doing its job. The people who build these things put a lot of thought into making the normal noises sound normal and the abnormal noises sound abnormal.
That's actually a good point. The acoustic design of the cabin is intentional. The normal sounds aren't alarming if you know what they are.
The problem is, most people don't know what they are, so they invent stories. The gear retracting becomes the engine falling off. The thrust reduction becomes the engine's dying. The flaps extending becomes the wing breaking.
The brain fills the silence with the worst available story.
The brain is a terrible passenger.
It is. And the fix is what Hannah found. Someone who knows the noises says that's normal, and the brain has a better story.
The brain needs a better story.
I think that's the whole thing. The fear is a story. The treatment is a better story.
A story with clunks and whirs and dings that mean what they mean.
A thump when the wheels touch down.
Clunk for retraction. Thump for touchdown.
Now you've got it.
The misconception people have about this topic is that a fear of flying must come from a bad flight or a fear of heights.
The evidence says it usually comes from a fear of losing control, and it surfaces when life gets fuller and there's more to lose. The plane is just where the anxiety shows up.
The fix is information and exposure, not avoidance. The anxiety is the treatment.
Which is a strange thing to say out loud, but it's what the data shows.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing and for the clunk correction.
This has been my weird prompts.
If you want to send us your own weird prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.